You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Judith Sears. Poisson. Coming up, Act 10, Right to Work, John Doe investigations, and a presidential run. Those are just some of the things that happened during Governor Walker's 8 years in office. We'll look back at his legacy coming up.
First, the famous Wisconsin idea says that the boundaries of our university system should be the boundaries of the state, and its work should benefit everyone. But a lot of people in Wisconsin and around the country feel that the academic world isn't holding up its end of the bargain.
That, combined with the denial of science by some high-profile politicians, has strained the relationship between higher education and the public. Our next guest says that rebuilding some of that trust is critical for the health of our economy and democracy.
Linda Stamato is the co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution and a faculty member at the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Be happy to be in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Linda, first of all, how would you assess the relationship between the general public and the academic world in 2018?
Well, I think there is a certain distance have been created really over the last several decades, building, I'd say, from the 70s. While people regard their universities highly by and large and want their children to attend college and university, there seems to be a growing skepticism of some of the work that's done there. But my sense of it is that a lot of that is driven by forces that are not pleased with the results of some of the research that take place, particularly when it comes to climatology, the environment, and public health. So I think they've got forces that have an interest and creating a conflict of interest and therefore undermining the public support for higher education. But I also think sometimes we're our own worst enemies, because there has been historically, I would say, a reluctance to, if I can use the word, translate research into more publicly accessible forms. And so a lot of the research that is done at colleges and universities don't reach the public in the way that it should, so that they don't really quite understand the quality and the importance of some of the work is being done. And I think we're also seeing less and less of academic researchers in the halls of legislatures and on television and in other public media. And instead we have, you know, Twitter and public other social media, which is exactly the best forum for discussing ideas that have to do with vaccines or climate change. So I think a number of things are contributing to it. But I'd say, Darrell, that really what we need to do is lessen that distance and gain greater respect across the divide. But I think it'll take both sides of the equation to focus on that.
Why do you think it's so important to have a trusting relationship between the public and academia?
Well, because I think we need verifiable facts, we need evidence we can trust, and we need to be sure that the policies we are following and the laws we're trying to pass and implement are based on something that's more than opinion. Basically, you know, it seems to me that we would like to believe that the surgeon that's operating on us knows what he or she is doing. I don't think we typically question that, and I don't think we question results of work in chemical experiments or in physics or even our ophthalmologist. But somehow or another, all of a sudden, we're worried about the people who work in the area of vaccines and the climate. You know, and why is that? I think because if you look at where the primary lobbyists are operating, it's in those areas. And so I think you have, an effort to raise skepticism where it's not merited, and it's not being resisted strongly enough. Actually, some of the things I've seen and some of my colleagues I've talked to, when they say they try to make themselves accessible to the public, you know, then when write, say, opinion columns or try to write in more accessible language so it's understandable to the general public, they are trolled by, if trolled is now a verb, criticized by people right and left for asserting their expertise as if expertise is somehow or another now a fault. So, I mean, I think those of us who have earned PhDs do think that it should mean something. And maybe that doesn't mean our views and our results shouldn't be contested. We need to be able to prove that what results we've produced are duplicative, but are duplicated by others, and that's the scientific method. But by and large, you know, I guess there's always that certain lack of certitude. You know, if we say that a vaccine is 97% effective, I mean, to me, that's a compelling figure. To someone else who may be less informed, they'd say, well, what about that 3%? So, you know, you got to figure out how you go about balancing what you need in order to understand the decision you should make. But now, when we have every reason to believe in the results of the effectiveness of most vaccines, there's a growing skepticism of them. In New Jersey, for example, we've just had an outbreak of 800 cases of measles when we haven't had anything close to that in decades. And why? Because some time ago there was a study that linked measles vaccine with autism. It's been disproven, but nonetheless, it is still active, live, and being shared on the internet. And as a result, if people want to use that as the source of their information for evidence and support, you know, they're going to reach the wrong conclusion. So it seems to me, you know, at least get four or five different takes on something before you reach a decision that may affect the life of your child and the public's health as well.
Linda, there are a lot of people that may see the world of higher education as elitist or isolated. Do you personally see any truth to that?
Well, you know, I think especially when we're talking about public university systems, when you think about this, since 1860, in the 60s, the Morrill Act, when Abraham Lincoln and Justin Morrill said, this is what we need to do for this nation, we need to create land-grant universities, and Wisconsin's one of them, and so is Rutgers. I mean, this was an effort to say we need something more than the education of chaplains, you know, in a very elite system of higher education, and that's largely what they created, and they weren't really very open to women or to African Americans at all then. So now we have this expanded system. I think the land-grant heritage, particularly its agricultural roots, has been widely respected and supported by the public. And I think, by and large, that tends to continue. I think what's happened is a general distrust that is fed by, well, conflicts of interest from the fossil fuel industry and a couple of others, but in my way of looking at this, it may not be widely known, but in 1971, Lewis Powell, who this was before he ascended to the United States Supreme Court, he was asked by the Chamber of Commerce to develop a blueprint to seek the ascendance of the business community because the Chamber of Commerce seemed to think business was under attack. And he wrote this several-page memorandum, which was written in 1971, as I said, but you read it now and you say, good grief, this sounds like it was written yesterday. And basically says, the fault for all of this anti-business attitude is the college campuses. Those intellectuals are the ones that are responsible. They're questioning the value of business, and they're supporting regulation. They're doing all of these anti-American things. We've got to fight back. And as I look at that memo and think about how it has now played out, the chamber became very active. There are a number of groups that created very corporate, pro-corporate think tanks on various college campuses, and there was a concerted effort to attack universities as somehow or another this liberal bastion that was against business. Now, I mean, it just sounds like so cliched, but I think that notion has prevailed, and it's been fed over time by those who are against regulation because it hurts their interests. And yet, I'm sure most citizens really do want clean air and clean water. And when they say they're against regulation, they're really against dumb or excessive regulations, not smart, essential ones that protect the medicines they take and the air that they breathe. But, you know, I mean, it's very hard to prove a negative. As a matter of fact, it really can't be done. So what do you have to do? You have to keep talking about the value of what you offer and justify the support of the public for the services you deliver, and to graduate students who can lead productive lives in the world and also are active citizens. So, you know, but I think most people seem to think that somehow or another, if you major in chemistry, you're going to come out liberal. I don't know that any, I mean, it may be that a chemist is a Democrat or a Republican, but I can't see how that enters into the periodic table. So I'd say that, and oh, by the way, Ronald, I just saw a recent survey by Pew that said that most students come into college fairly liberal and they graduate more moderate. So, I mean, that's the opposite of what people would tend to think if you ask them, but that's what's happening. So there's a need for some greater understanding of what it is we're doing and what it is we're hoping we deserve the public support for. I think it's our responsibility, as well as it is those who are making the kinds of comments about a higher education they're making and basically undercutting its essential purpose. I think I was looking at some of the congressional hearings and some of the hearings that are done in state legislatures, and there are less and less academic researchers appearing and more lobbyists.
We're talking with Linda Stamato, co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at Rutgers University, and we're looking at the relationship between the public and academia.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you aren't currently working or studying in higher education, do you see the work of universities as worthwhile? Why or why not? What do you think academics could do better to relate to people off campus? If you do research or teach at a university, have you faced criticism of your work? How do you or your colleagues respond? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Linda Stamato of Rutgers University, digging into the relationship between academia and the general public.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you work in higher education, do you think academics could do a better job of communicating with the public? What do you want skeptics of your work to know? And if you're not in the academic world, how do you see the role of universities? If you don't think they're doing enough, how can they improve? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Linda, my apologies for cutting you off, but we were up against the break. But I wanted to continue this conversation and ask you, you know, what can scholars do to break the perception of higher education being isolated or elitist and connect on a more meaningful level with people that aren't a part of the university?
You know, that's an excellent question. You know, I think there's a lot of continuing education program opportunities for people, you know, to check in, you know, at no cost to understand what's going on in areas of their interest. And so I think that's one way. I think they could reach into the community through local education programs, make themselves available as speakers on topics that might be of interest to people in the community, whether it's, you know, the current, the most noted climate report that just came out recently, or on any subject at all. It seems to me adult schools, for example, is another option. Religious groups that gathered and have topical talks on things of interest to them, or even garden clubs. You know, it seems to me there are a variety of options in communities where scholars can have their presence known, and it's a challenge for them to be able to talk in ways with community members about their needs, their interests, their concerns, and in fact, even general questions about what's the value of higher education. We know, we see that students who graduate with degrees tend to earn more over their life course than those without them, but what else does it mean? What does it mean in terms of quality of life and perspective, and what does it have to do with civic engagement to the extent that we care about our communities, our states, our nation? You know, how engaged are we? Another concern sometimes of people is that there's not enough civic education going on, not only in colleges, but in high schools as well. what's their view on that, and how can we help? I think there need to be more conversations with the public and academics about what they'd like to see their colleges doing in their communities, not just helping us, you know, combat mosquitoes and so forth through our land grant programs, but really more expansive. What is philosophy and history and sociology, in fact, chemistry and physics? What can that offer? So that's I'd like to see greater outreach, but I'd also like to see colleges making themselves more accessible on campus and off to the public.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ben in Beloit. Ben, welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'd like to bring up something from a slightly different point of view about some of the things that are making it difficult for the public to properly appreciate things, particularly in science and its method. I just remember that, you know, these days, for example, if you look at school libraries, particularly at the elementary and secondary level in large urban systems, it's very hard to actually have a real honest-to-God librarian there who's teaching the concept of what's called source authentication at the elementary and secondary level, because that's like that's a fundamental thing of how do you know that what you're reading or talking about or thinking about is from someone who's authoritative? If that concept isn't brought to somebody very early on, I mean, they could conceivably choose to look at the fact that anybody who's in a public medium is an authority because they don't have a critical capacity to look carefully at that question. Another thing is that within the academy itself, unfortunately, there is a problem, particularly from the modern humanities and social sciences, with an assault on the idea that human beings can actually achieve objectivity. In other words, that they're capable of setting aside their biases in the service of finding objective truth. Many of the philosophical approaches and other methods end up working strongly against that. I think that, you know, that's sort of a couple, I think, of some very basic things that I never hear really addressed when talking about these kinds of questions.
Thanks so much for the call, Ben. What are your thoughts on Ben's statement about librarians, Linda?
Okay, let me just say one thing for Gail. Okay, let's talk about the librarians. I think Ben's larger point really is how do you find the authentic source? How do you know that what you're looking at has validity, legitimacy, has been tested, is trust, you can trust it? I think that it's an extraordinarily important question. And frankly, you know, the New York Times a little while ago had a comparative thing on a full page. Which thing are you reading do you think comes from a reliable source and which is illegitimate, which came from a Russian troll, essentially? And I'm telling you, it was really difficult to be able to recognize it. The thing that was key was the misspellings by the troll, but that's not very good. But to raise the point about how do you know what you're looking at has legitimacy, I tend to think that professional associations are a fairly good source for double-checking something, because that's what governs the professions themselves. And people are not members of those associations unless they have the credentials and the responsibility and have acknowledged their commitment to those principles. So that's one thing. When it comes to medical knowledge, I mean, basically you use the major medical sources, whether it's Memorial Sloan Kettering or WebMD, and a couple of those that have established their legitimacy. But, you know, as far as going to a public library and actually finding a person that can help you do that, you know, libraries are, fortunately, they're at least in New Jersey, they're funded by a requirement on all municipal government budgets, so they at least get something. But they're cutting back at every level, and I'm afraid that a lot are cutting back on resource support, and I think that's unfortunate. But I think it's a good thing to raise, Ben, with your local library, what substitutes for that person behind the desk in the resource section now? Because we need to have that, and the community needs to know how to go about doing it. So some sources to be suggested, even put on a poster board in the library, might be a good way to begin. And as for human beings being 100% objective, you couldn't be more right. But I think people are also demanding from experts that they have 100% certitude on something in order to believe it. And we're never going to achieve that, and if we do, we may not recognize it if we did. I mean, I think reasonable figures, I said this earlier, if you have a 97% rate of success with a vaccine, that's pretty convincing. You don't have to wait for 99.9% in order to figure this is something I ought to do. I ought to vaccinate my child. So I think the need for certitude when it doesn't exist and recognizing what's a reasonable level of acceptability, that's something important for people to understand. It is, and all life is very complex, but if we get a sense as to how we can navigate that world, I think we're going to be on more firm footing.
Linda, we have just a couple minutes, so
sure.
I wanted to ask you one last question. Overall, are you optimistic that the situation is going to improve anytime soon?
Well, I think it may improve when the polarizing politics improve. I think it's gotten worse under those circumstances because people are so angry, they're looking for targets everywhere. But I think overall, I tend to agree with President Obama about that arc, that we are actually moving toward a progressive future. And I think that part of the great progress in the last 100 years, much of it has been driven by academic research and by the education of engineers and doctors and artists and lawyers in our academic institutions. And I think that with those who have also been trained in the professions and in plumbing and trucking and all the other essential services that are done in this nation, we will get our act together and recognize where we can find the most valuable expertise. I don't think it's going to be easy, and I think there are going to be people against it because their conflicts get in the way. But I'm hoping that optimism will win out over personal greed and that we'll return to being what I think is the open and tolerant and a nation that wants to explore and to learn and to live well.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us. Linda Stamato is the co-director of the Center for Negotiation and Conflict Resolution and a facility member at the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. She was with us to talk about ways to build more trust between the public and academia.
Governor Walker has about another week and a half in office before handing over the keys to Tony Evers.
In the 8 years Walker has been in charge, he curtailed the power of public sector unions, made Wisconsin a right-to-work state, and convinced Foxconn to build a massive facility in Racine County. He was also the first governor in U.S. history to win a recall election, was hounded by two John Doe investigations, and had an unsuccessful run for president.
But it was the deal he struck a couple of weeks ago through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation that he really wants people to remember. That $28 million agreement with Kimberly-Clark keeps open a plant in the Fox Valley, saving nearly 400 jobs.
To me, if there was any talk about a legacy, I want this to be my legacy, that we protected these kind of jobs, not as a handout, but because we knew if we invest in people like you, you won't let us down.
What do you think is Governor Walker's legacy? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And Matt Rothschild is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He joins us in studio. Matt, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Judith. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Matt, let's start with you. What do you think is Governor Walker's legacy?
Well, it's disgraceful. He was devastating for our democracy, devastating for our environment, devastating for public education, both K through 12 in the UW system, devastating for local control, devastating for the norms of acceptable political behavior in a democracy. So good riddance to Scott Walker.
Well, Chris, I'm guessing you might have a different perspective. What would you say?
Well, yeah, you guess right. I think that a lot of his legacy is based on the economy. When he first ran for governor, he promised 250,000 jobs. He didn't quite get that done in his first term, but he did get it done. And he has overseen an economy that has turned around and is in highly charged mode, doing exceptionally well with lower unemployment rates than the national average and other key markers that show that we're exceeding national averages in terms of job growth, employment, and the overall economic picture. So it's fitting that Governor Walker wants to make the Kimberly-Clark piece a cornerstone of his legacy, because I think jobs are a big part of that.
So, Chris, that's something that you're looking at over a long period of time. Governor Walker was criticized, mostly by Democrats, for signing a package of lame duck bills that restricts early voting and limits some powers of the incoming governor and attorney general. They said that the legislation amounted to a power grab. Chris, do you see this as a stain on his legacy, that he signed those?
No, I don't. I do understand why the Democrats are squealing about this, although the fact is in other states, throughout the U.S., we've seen both parties attempt to do, some similar actions here. So the optics are not great. And even a lot of Republicans will admit that. It does not look good. I do think that if Governor Walker had won, leadership in the legislature had long talked about trying to make some of these changes by working with the governor. But, the optics are bad. They made these changes and pushed them through, in a lame duck session. That said, I do think that the Democrats are overplaying their hand and squealing, a little bit too loudly over these changes, which in the grand scheme of things, I think will prove to be relatively minor in terms of, quote unquote, curbing the powers of the attorney general and the governor. I think that's overreaching.
Matt, would you say that this is mostly optics, or do you think these are bills that are going to stick with Walker and his legacy?
Well, it's grotesque hypocrisy at the very least. I mean, Scott Walker and Scott Fitzgerald and Robin Voss had no problem whatsoever with a strong governor when Scott Walker was sitting in the governor's chair, or a strong attorney general when it was held by a Republican, Brad Schimmel, but all of a sudden they've got enormous problems with those powers when Democrats are coming in the door. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And Chris, how would you respond to that? I mean, you said this is something they talked about, but in fact, they did not do it until they lost. Why now, yeah, if that was a real value?
Well, I mean, when I talk about optics, I mean, that is definitely part of it. I understand where Matt is coming from. I also believe that if the shoe were on the other foot, I would not put it past Democrats to do that. The fact is, this is just a partisan thing. And it's, this time it's Republicans in power. Next time it'll be Democrats in power. The fact is, both parties have tried to do this. It doesn't look great, but I think, again, they're overstating the effect that these laws are actually going to have on Governor Evers and Attorney General Call.
We're taking a look at Governor Walker's tenure in Wisconsin and what his legacy may be. Chris Lotto is with us, a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin, and Matt Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Matt, we heard Governor Walker in that clip a few minutes ago talking about Kimberly-Clark, saying that he wants to be remembered for fighting to save those family-supporting jobs. In exchange for the $28 million from WEDIC, the company will need to have an annual payroll of more than $30 million. It will also invest up to $200 million at the plant over the next 5 years. How do you see this deal with Kimberly-Clark, Matt? Is it a good thing for Wisconsin?
I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think Foxconn was a good thing. I think Scott Walker was the biggest corporate welfare queen we've ever had. I mean, the guy did not represent the citizens of Wisconsin. He represented Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. He represented the Koch brothers. He represented anyone who would put a coin in his reelection cup. Instead of representing the interests of the overwhelming number of citizens in Wisconsin. And he was always carrying water for his paymasters from day one, when he wanted to drop a bomb on organized labor, till the time he was pushing through those lame duck bills. And it's just all of a piece. Same thing with not calling special elections when the law required him to call special elections. This is a guy who had no respect for the law. He had no respect for the law when he was violating it, when he was coordinating with outside groups, when there was a statute on the books here that said you can't coordinate with outside groups. And so, it's just, it's all been in this one stripe for Scott Walker since day one. And I think it's just been one disgrace after another. I don't think there's been any single person in the history of Wisconsin who's done more damage to this state than Scott Walker.
Chris, I'll actually ask you to respond to that last part. But first, I want to touch on Kimberly-Clark again, because this was not easy for the governor to get through. He was not getting, I think, the support he wanted and expected from his own party. Is that part of his legacy, that he wasn't able to bring them along on this, what he is staking his legacy on?
No, I don't think that. I mean, I wouldn't put too much into, one last minute effort that the governor made, that he was trying to find support in the middle of, a busy season, busy time of year, changes happening in the legislature and at the state level. in administration. No, I'm not necessarily surprised by that, and I wouldn't read too much into it. I think, the governor's quote, I think encapsulates what he wanted to do. Ultimately, he wants to be seen as a job creator, and this is one of those efforts that he had to undertake that he felt was important to help save those jobs, similar to Foxconn. I have been on public radio before and have talked about Foxconn, and Foxconn, that price tag is alarmingly high. And I understand, there's a fair number of Republicans who really have, even ones that would tell you that they support it, that are uneasy and want to make sure that the state gets what they paid for here. So obviously, we have to keep a close eye on it, and the legislature and Republican leadership in the legislature has to hold Foxconn to account to make sure that that happens. But the fact remains, we have a lot of jobs out there, a lower than the national average unemployment rate that continues to head down. Folks who want to work in Wisconsin, the jobs are out there. And basically, Scott Walker has overseen a return to Wisconsin hanging up the sign that says we're open for business.
Well, and Chris, I want to give you a chance to respond to Matt in saying that Walker is one of the worst things that's ever happened to Wisconsin. But clearly he had a lot of support from his base until these last elections. What would you point to as the thing that you are most proud of as part of the Republican Party that he has done?
I think that, a lot of the promises that he made, he was able to keep, and the ones that he wasn't, a lot of times he was, he sought to find compromise. I think on the biggest ones that he wanted to do, again, creation of jobs and overseeing an economic recovery, I don't think there's any argument that he has been able to do that. I think on things like lowering the income tax and freezing tuition at the UW level, he was able to accomplish that, freezing property taxes, reducing taxes on employers, lowering income taxes. A lot of economic development bills that he made, the forefront of his agenda, he was able to get done. And a lot of other things in terms of what he wanted to see with ending early prison release. Voter ID, which has been for decades an issue that that the state has needed and that certainly those of us in the Republican Party have been hoping to see, and we're finally getting that on the books. This governor in two terms has accomplished a great deal and a great deal of things that he said he was going to do. So, there shouldn't be a whole lot of surprises here. He laid out an ambitious agenda and over two terms got a heck of a lot of that done.
Matt, before we turn to the phones at 800-642-1234, I want to zero in on voter ID. What's your take on the voter ID issue being one of the linchpins of the Walker administration?
Well, it's one of the disgusting assaults on democracy that he waged in his 8 years. It was the account even of the chief of staff of a Republican state senator, an effort to disenfranchise African-Americans and young people. And that chief of staff said that the Republican state senators were giddy that they were doing it right after they passed the vote. And this is part of an assault on democracy in tune with rigging of the maps, the horrible gerrymandering that happened in 2010, 2011, the destruction of the Government Accountability Board, the grotesque rewrite of the campaign finance bill in 2015 that Walker signed that allowed corporations for the first time in more than 100 years to give to political parties and legislative campaign committees and let rich people give double the amounts that they used to give to their favorite candidates for office. So to me, this wasn't a guy who compromised. I don't know where Chris got that. I mean, he dropping the bomb on organized labor wasn't a compromise. He wasn't a guy who kept his promises. He said, right to work would never come to his desk. Don't even ask me about it. And the second it came to his desk, he pulled out his pen and signed the sucker. So, this was a man who was always serving the right-wing corporate agenda, and it's been devastating for the environment, too. We haven't mentioned that, really, except in passing. You couldn't mention climate change on the DNR's website. He fired DNR scientists. He signed this bill about high-capacity wells that are draining trout streams and lakes up north so that people who have their cottages, family cottages up north, the pier doesn't reach the water anymore. The water's receded 100 feet. So it's just been, wherever you look, a disaster.
Let's go to the phones, and Ann in Campbellsport is up first. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I would say Scott Walker's legacy is going to be divide and conquer, from eliminating collective bargaining, which he did not campaign on, to environment has suffered through the diminishment of the DNR, dropping our world-class status of the UW system to the disgraceful lame duck session. So I tend to agree. I think this is one of the worst governors we've ever had.
So, Chris, I want to ask you to respond, and thanks for that call. Divide and conquer. Does that sound like the administration that you've been watching for 8 years?
There are certain things that I think that this Republican governor went after and got, and there were things, obviously, that did not have Democrat support. But I think that, again, when you talk about what he was charged with doing and what he said he was going to do and looking at the big picture of where this state was when he came into office versus where he's leaving it 8 years later in terms of, you know, economic development, economic growth, in terms of taxation, in terms of the things that he said he was going to do that were important to him as governor, and he has done all of those things. So, I get that. You know, Matt Rothschild is out of breath with his long laundry list of things that Scott Walker has failed on. I'm sure that come January, Matt's going to be thrilled to have Tony Evers in office and everything's going to be great again after 8 years of apparently Scott Walker leading the state to annihilation. But clearly he did not do that. And in fact, he has overseen, a state that is exploding with growth and is handing that off to Governor Evers. And hopefully that's going to continue.
I mean, the question is, you know, how much credit really does Scott Walker get for the economy? Here we have Chris saying this over and over again, but if you chart the unemployment rate nationally, it was 9.7 in 2010, and it's 3.7 now. In Wisconsin, it was, when Walker came in, it was 8.7, it's 3.0 now. I mean, that graph looks pretty much the same.
We're looking back at Governor Walker's 8 years in office and what he'll most be remembered for. Chris Lotto, a former communications director for the state Republican Party, and Matt Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, are our guests.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think Scott Walker's legacy is? What do you think were the high points and low points of his time in office? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. We're talking about Governor Scott Walker as he wraps up his eighth and final year in office. Matt Rothschild and Chris Lotto are here to discuss his legacy. Matt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Chris is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. And I want to go back to the start of the Walker era when he introduced his budget repair bill, commonly known as Act 10, to address a $3.6 billion deficit. It eliminated collective bargaining for public employees and required public workers to contribute more for their health insurance plans and pensions. The proposal set off massive protests at the Capitol. And I want to go to the phones because Joan in Eau Claire wants to talk about those protests. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. Part of Walker's legacy will be those images of hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites protesting his right-wing policies, not to mention the images of Wisconsin citizens being arrested for singing in our state capitol. That's our state capitol. I couldn't be happier that I witnessed Walker's election loss to Tony Evers. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thanks, Joan. And Chris, what is your take on Act 10 as part of Scott Walker's legacy? He started his tenure with that act.
Well, yeah, when I was first asked to be on the show and thinking about his legacy, obviously Act 10 was right at the top. And of course, opinions and perspectives are going to vary wildly on that. But I definitely think I will go this far with the caller that it is going to be one of his defining issues. And obviously, Republicans and conservatives see it through a very different prism from, Matt Rothschild and your callers. It was one of those things that was a seismic change in Wisconsin that he took on very early after being elected. And clearly it was a topic of discussion for some. Some considered him a hero for it. Others considered him, something else that I can't say on the air. But it's definitely a part of his legacy, no doubt about it.
And Chris, is there anything that you, looking back, think maybe it could have been handled differently? We talked about optics earlier. Would you have changed anything?
You know, I don't know if there... That's a great question. I mean, in hindsight is 2020, and you could say, well, gee, maybe he should have, done this or that or looked for another way to work it through. I think the fact is it got through. And I think that the fact that he was then able to survive a recall considering how heated politics were and how heated both sides were in Wisconsin at the time, that he was still able to not only survive that and then get reelected, I think speaks more to where the state was at with Scott Walker's agenda and that they supported that.
And Matt?
Well, he rammed it through. It just didn't get through. And he rammed it through because he was doing what Ann said. He was trying to divide and conquer. That wasn't Ann's term. That actually was Scott Walker's term when Scott Walker was talking to Diane Hendricks, the richest woman in Wisconsin, an ABC supply down in Beloit, who has given more than $500,000 to Scott Walker's campaigns in Wisconsin and gave more than $5 million to his presidential campaign. She came up to him after he got elected and before he was sworn in and said, when are you going to turn Wisconsin into a red state? When are you going to turn Wisconsin into a right-to-work state? And that's when Walker told her, first, we're going to divide and conquer. And I think that's a terrible thing for a governor to say, just as I think it's terrible to say we're going to drop a bomb on Wisconsin, too. And so, they had the power. They used the power to the max. I suppose if you're, a political partisan on the conservative side, you're delighted that they used their power to the max. But I thought it was not certainly Wisconsin nice, not the way we usually operate in Wisconsin. When you destroy the norms of behavior the way they did, that's corrosive of democracy itself.
So, Chris, I want to talk about Scott Walker's future. He ran for president in 2015, was considered briefly as a top-level candidate, and then ran out of steam pretty quickly, withdrew in September of that year. And he's only 51 years old, leaving what many, like you, see as a very successful tenure as governor of Wisconsin. What do you see coming next for Scott Walker?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I know some people said, he's gonna go work for the Trump administration. But I mean, I don't know that. If you believe his public proclamations, and if you look at the average shelf life, professionally speaking, of somebody who goes to work under President Trump, it's not something that you're going to be able to build a long term career on. So I have a hard time believing as somebody who spent so much of his professional life, in service in Milwaukee County, in the legislature, and as governor, that he would just want to walk away from that. If I had a crystal ball and had to guess, I'd say I would think he would look for a way to stay in the political realm. You know, what form that ends up taking is anybody's guess, but I feel like it's in his blood. And I could be completely wrong, but I have a feeling that he would want to continue on in some form.
And Matt, whether or not you would like to see him go on to something else, what would you see would be maybe a natural stepping stone for the ways that he has positioned himself?
I think he's going to get paid. He's in personal debt. He's carried water for these guys for 8 years. He's been very dutiful. They're going to reward him. I think he's going to go work for the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, or the Bradley Foundation, or some right-wing corporate outfit that is going to make him whole.
Well, Chris and Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Matt Rothschild is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We talked with them about the legacy of Governor Scott Walker after 8 years in the job. Sorry to those callers that we couldn't get to. There are articles relating to this on WPR.org. You can certainly leave some comments there.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a biologist shares that the species in our homes can be as diverse as those in a far corner of a tropical rainforest, and that's a good thing. We'll talk with the author of Never Home Alone.
New Year's Eve is right around the corner, and on Food Friday, we'll get some great tips for delicious ways to ring in 2019.
And a free trial of a product or subscription might seem like a good way to try something out, but many consumers end up stuck with a contract that's hard to get out of. We'll get advice on how to avoid those traps.
All that and more coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.